Week 13 of the NFL season is almost upon us. Yay or nay on Brock Osweiler. We deep dive three games we cannot wait to see. We have a monster-sized mailbag, and I make Andy Benoit give us a bold prediction about Sunday's games. All that and much more on the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast. This is the debut episode. I am Gary Gramling. I am here, as always, with Andy Benoit. And Andy, we are taking a, as the title would imply, look ahead to this weekend's games.
And that's the way to do it. I'm excited for this. We're going to go a little deeper into the games that we've chosen.
Yep, we're going to have a preview of our three headlining games of the week. But let's start with the big story. We'll call it this top story. I don't know what else we'd call it in this case, but let's talk some Brock Osweiler. Bill O'Brien came out and said, in a nod to Bruce Hornsby, Brock Osweiler is our starting quarterback, and that's the way it is. Now, a lot of people are calling for Tom Savage to get the start in Houston. They're ready to pull the plug on the whole Osweiler era. What's your opinion, Andy? Do you think it's time for a change here? And even setting aside that the option is obviously an unproven backup, do you see any signs of Osweiler working out in the next 2 to 3 seasons in Houston?
Well, let's take it one season at a time and one game at a time, because there's no point. The Texans aren't going to even be thinking about that right now. That's an off-season question of what to do with him long term. I don't think you make the change. I don't know anything about Tom Savage except that he's been there for a little while and they still chose to bring in Osweiler, and they know about Savage. And so the people around him, we forget how comfortable the coaches are or uncomfortable they become with guys. They're around these guys every day. So how they use them, whether they play a guy or not, or how they play him, they tell you everything they think about a guy and what they do there. And there's two things that stand out. One, they don't play Tom Savage. They've chosen not to. And then two, as of late, they have really watered down the offense, or to create a word, remedialized the offense, simplified, for Osweiler. And it's not that he doesn't process mentally well, although I think there's a little bit of that. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in this system. They ask, as he said, made a great point to the Monday night guys before that Raiders game. He said, our offense is deals in a lot of gray areas. It's a very gray offense, and that's a good way to put it, because they do option routes, they do either or type routes. There's a lot of reads to make on the fly, and they don't necessarily have the receivers to do that successfully either. DeAndre Hopkins is unreliable on a lot of those. Will Fuller's a rookie. Braxton Miller's a rookie plus. He's still learning the basics of wide receiver, so the receivers don't fit that system. Osweiler's not comfortable in it, and the other thing, Gary, is he's not very twitchy. Everything he does is a little bit slow, and he's a bigger guy. That's the reason. It's just there's more body for him to deal with when he's making decisions. So what they've done is adjusted the offense, which is what good coaches do, and a team that pretty much did not use its tight ends at all last season, they're now built around their tight ends. They're playing more of them at one time, and they're throwing to those guys more. I would stick with that formula. They're at the top of the AFC South. Chances are they're going to get more comfortable with that before they get less comfortable. I don't think you change quarterbacks now at this point in the season, because then what do you do with the offense? You're going to go back to what you tried early in the year?
Yeah.
Or do you keep the new offense? I mean, it's too many bizarre questions to deal with.
Yeah, it was funny, last offseason, I know Bill O'Brien was talking a lot about, after they signed Osweiler, they still love Tom Savage, and I thought that was a smokescreen. I really thought they were going after Christian Hackenberg in the second round and getting O'Brien's old pupil in there as their developmental guy, but apparently they do like Savage enough to have him as their lone developmental quarterback. But I want to back up real quick, Andy, to last February. When you were looking at Brock Osweiler, pending free agent, was he a good prospect? Regardless of system, was he a guy who you looked at and said, this is a starting NFL quarterback?
Yeah, I guess so. Just because that's a skill set question then.
Yeah.
Does he have starting quarterback tools? I don't think he has the best arm in the world. He's a little bit of a ball pusher rather than a velocity thrower. So, but he's good enough. The rest of it, though, is so he's a good enough NFL passer, but as an NFL quarterback, he's a big mystery. He was then, and he kind of remained so, because Denver played with him the same way Houston is, which is to say they played around him. They did not ask him to do a lot. They hid him in their game plans. That's how Denver was built. They're still built that way with Simeon, by the way. So the Texans, no team, and Peter King did a good job of writing about this. We all know that the Texans had never met Brock Osweiler before they signed him. Well, they also could not possibly have gotten adequate information on him just watching the film, because there wasn't enough out there. So really, no team in NFL history, you could say, has ever made such a large investment at the quarterback position in so much of the dark. I mean, they went into this thing very blind, and I get it. It's hard to find QBs if you're going to risk on that position, but they're still learning what they have in Osweiler, and the more they learn, the more they seem to scale things back.
Yeah, you know, I'm not an Osweiler guy. I did not like the signing, and I have not liked what I've seen in 2016. I'm curious to see Tom Savage, but, you know, I think that's what it is. I think it's more people outside of the Texans organization are saying, well, we'd like to see what this guy can do. They kind of know what Tom Savage can and can't do, and if they don't think he's an upgrade over Brock Osweiler, I think that's something you just have to take at face value at this point. I mean, all we want for Christmas is Tom Savage out on the field in a regular season game, I guess.
Everybody loves the backup. I mean, there's going to be four or five backup QBs every season in the NFL that become the darlings of their local town, and that's the guy everybody wants to see. And this season, Tom Savage is one of those guys. But coaches know their players, and if they wanted Savage to play, they would have gone with him rather than choose a quarterback that they really knew nothing about. They chose a mystery over Tom Savage this offseason.
Yeah. No, that's the old A.J. Feely thing. A.J. Feely should have been mayor of Philadelphia if he ever wanted to get out of football early. I got one last question for you on Osweiler and the Texans here. Why were they better with Brian Hoyer last year, or were they not necessarily better than Hoyer last year? And you know, this is just sort of the result doesn't match up with sort of the process.
That's a really interesting question, because Hoyer, we forget. Look, the reason he's not there is the playoff game. Even they have trouble looking past that, just like fans can't get it out of their head. He had a miserable playoff game, and it was in the biggest moment, and so he becomes hard to sell, not just to your fan base, but maybe even your locker room after that. Mm-hmm. So that's what it was. But before that, during the rest of the season, we forget how well he played at times. He was solid for him. Even in the first week of the season where he got benched midway through, they've admitted, Bill O'Brien admitted that was a mistake, and I would go so far as to say that was one of the worst coaching decisions made all season long, and the reason they benched him is because the home crowd was booing him, and they panicked, and NFL coaches don't usually do that, especially in week one. But going back and watching that game carefully and getting a chance to learn about Houston's system this offseason and having some of the stuff that was taught to me, Hoyer played very well even in that game. It was issues with the wide receivers and chemistry there that was the concern. So I guess, Gary, to answer your question, I don't know why they couldn't overcome the playoff game. But to expound on the question, I don't know. I think they also have forgot a little bit of what the good parts of Brian Hoyer were, because who's to say he wouldn't have been much better in that scheme in a second season? Again, keep in mind, it's not an easy scheme to just step in and run all of a sudden.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think Osweiler is your guy until, let's say, next October or something like that, and then you can really decide whether you want to pull the plug or not. But, you know, like I said, hadn't met him, and it's a quick turnaround trying to learn the system and, you know, create chemistry with your receivers. A lot of new bodies there, so
they're
Osweiler's
making
a guy
work,
in Houston,
and
as Bruce Hornsby says, that's just the way it is. All right, we're going to jump ahead to our three favorite games of the upcoming Sunday. We are going to start with Giants and Steelers. Big classic game here, and we're going to deep dive into a couple of topics here. Andy, the Giants had the fifth-ranked rushing defense in the NFL, and we talked a little bit about this on Monday's show. You know, when it comes to stats, they're not exact. I mean, it gives you a snapshot, and the Giants have not faced a lot of great teams of late. I think that's not a secret. They are going to see Le'Veon Bell and a very good Steelers rushing game on Sunday. Who do you like better in this battle, and how do you think this thing sets up?
The Steelers' rushing game is an interesting one because they really have two identities out of it. They do inside zone, which is just straight ahead, north and south, double teams in the point of attack, double teams right up on the front line, and somebody works off of that double team and right up to the linebacker. It's just what you think of when you think of running the ball between the tackles. Mm-hmm. So that's one dimension they do. But then the other thing they'll do is go with their gap scheme concepts, and that is pull blockers, plays like power, or in their case they run a lot of counter, which is power only with a misdirection element. And counter is really their best run. And DeCastro, David DeCastro, the right guard, he's the guy who's the lead blocker, the pull blocker on almost all of their counter plays. And it fits Le'Veon Bell very well because it's a slower developing run. And so it really highlights Bell's patience as a runner, which is his best trait. So it'll be fun to see what they do. I think they'll go with more of the counter stuff because, Gary, the other thing they do, they don't just alternate between these. They run these plays in bunches. So they might go inside zone for one series. The next series, they'll go counter for 5 out of 6 plays. But they call them in bunches, and they look to get a rhythm that way. I think the bunches, we'll see it with their rushing attack, they're going to do this counter stuff because the Giants don't have an easy defensive line to just line up and try to out-maul. You can't move Damon Harrison easily.
Yeah.
You can't move Jonathan Hankins easily. I would make those guys play diagonally, and I'd make the linebackers have to move diagonally, and you do that by getting to the outside with gap scheme runs.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this a linebacking core that can handle that if you can sort of do some things to sort of nullify what especially Harrison and Hankins can do in the middle of this line?
It can be. It's a unique linebacking core because every player has limitations, but every player has specific strengths as well. And Steve Spagnuolo's done a good job of finding the packages that put the guys in the right position. Kelvin Shepard, for example, is their middle linebacker on base downs. He doesn't play in coverage much, although he's been good in coverage mentally this year when he's had opportunities. But he's their base down guy. He's a short area player with size. The guy who's really the X factor, though, is Devin Kennard, and he's their strong side linebacker. And in that scheme, what Spagnuolo does a lot is puts the strong side linebacker up on the line of scrimmage, almost as basically a fifth defensive lineman. And it's that guy's job to hold the point and clog the edge, set the edge, as some would call it. So how Kennard plays could very well dictate how things go in this run game and whether he can set the edge consistently against Pittsburgh's tight ends.
All right. Now, two guys who, well, we're not short on publicity for the two receivers in this game. The two guys who topped our offseason position rankings at the receiver position, Antonio Brown on one side, Odell Beckham on the other side. Now, the Steelers secondary, they see Antonio Brown every day in practice. They will be going up against Odell Beckham, and my two-part question for you is, one, the basic question is, how do they guard him with a secondary that is, you know, there's no shutdown guy who you're going to say, well, he's going to travel with Odell. And two, you know, we talked about this a little bit. How are the Giants doing over the last couple weeks as far as sort of scheming Odell Beckham open pre-snap?
They've done a better job with it. What'll be interesting to see, and really when you say scheme Odell Beckham open pre-snap, what you mean is simply where he lines up. Because the Giants don't use a lot of pre-snap motion. They don't do stacks and bunches a whole lot. They're pretty isolation-oriented in their receiving core. And you can play that way when you have guys like Odell Beckham and Victor Cruz, who it's reasonably expected that they're going to be better than their opponents. They move Beckham around a little more. What'll be interesting to see is if they put him on the weak side or the strong side, because what Keith Butler, the Steelers defensive coordinator, likes to do, and he's done this, I know I was there one day in training camp and sat with Butler at lunchtime, and he said, "Hey, this afternoon we're gonna throw these blitzes on against Antonio Brown and get him frustrated because he hasn't seen these all camp, and we're gonna beat Antonio Brown this afternoon's practice." And what the blitzes are, they will take from the slot, they'll blitz their slot cornerback and roll the coverage behind him. So what you get is cover two on the side of a blitz, and why that's so unique is, for one, that's a lot of bodies over there. You're rushing one guy and replacing him, so you're basically going one-on-one on the other side and playing cover two on the side that you blitz from. Quarterbacks are trained to throw at the blitz. They see a blitz coming, they think, oh, that's one less body on that side of the field. Here I go, I'm going to throw. And the Steelers understand that, and they do trap coverages out of cover two behind it. They haven't done it a whole lot this year, but they also haven't seen a guy like Odell Beckham before. So if the Giants are a quick strike passing team as well, and you want to do these trap coverages against the quick strike throws. The people who saw the Thanksgiving game with Darius Slay on that interception at the end, that's what we're talking about. So they do that kind of coverage concept, only they blitz in front of it to make you want to throw that ball. If Odell Beckham's on that strong side, I bet they do that. I bet they bring the blitz because they don't have guys who can cover him. And so you might as well try to beat his quarterback through scheme. If Beckham's on the weak side, though, and the Giants are putting him away from the slot, then it's a different story. And then you probably get straight double teams over the top, and whether that works or not remains to be seen.
Okay. And conversely, other side of the ball, how do the Giants guard Antonio Brown?
Brown and Beckham are so close skill set wise. Do you think people talk about that enough? Like, if I said to you, Gary, who's most similar in the NFL to Odell Beckham, who would come to mind?
I think you'd have to say Brown, because we talked about this offseason. When you're talking about the elite receivers in the game, I mean, the other names are the big guys. Julio Jones, Dez Bryant, and I'm not sure who else you'd possibly say could match up with Beckham's skill set as a 5'10", 5'11 guy.
Yeah. And what makes both of those guys so unique is their body control and their quickness. And when you are a great athlete, like the reason Le'Veon Bell's so patient as a runner is because he has such quick twitch that he can afford to be patient because he can snap back on schedule the second he decides to. So the same with Amari Cooper as a route runner. Some of these really patient players have elite body control and quickness, and that's what Beckham and Brown have. So they're extremely hard to play against because with those traits, a good route can still beat your coverage when the coverage concept wins. I mean, Roethlisberger will throw to Brown and against the exact wrong coverages that you could draw up. And when I was at Steelers camp, I asked him about that, and he said, "Brown's the one guy I'll do that for." Yes, he knows he's thrown into the wrong coverage, but he doesn't care. It's Antonio Brown.
Yep.
So we see, what are you going to do? I don't know what you're going to do, but what the Giants have done more of as a team lately is blitz. And when you blitz, then you become the dictating team most of the time because now the ball is coming out on your schedule, not on the quarterback schedule. And maybe that's the solution. Maybe you blitz. I don't know if you put Janoris Jenkins in on Brown. Brown will play on the outside on the weak side. They haven't been putting him in the slot as much. Jenkins would be their best fit for a corner playing on the weak side. What would you do? I mean, it's a no-win situation. Teams have stopped Brown, but it's often a flow of the game type of thing. It's when Brown doesn't produce, it's the whole Steelers offense isn't producing, and he's part of that. And I think that's why you'd blitz him, wouldn't you, to get the flow of the game on your terms?
I mean, the one thing I think you can blitz a little bit more. The one sort of break the Giants are catching here is Sammy Coates. He's not. Basically has one hand, and he couldn't catch that well with two hands anyway. So, you're not. I don't know what Hayward Bay's status is off the top of my head, but the Steelers are banged up with those big play guys. So, you're not taking quite as much risk as you would normally if you just want to attack heavily with the blitz.
Is this in New York?
This is in Pittsburgh, and.
Oh, okay.
This is, the Steelers offense. This is a different offense at home, especially when it comes to Ben in the passing game. 345.2 yards per game at home, 271 on the road, 112.6 passer rating at home, 86.8 on the road. That is since 2014 regular season games for Ben. And this is a team, they averaged 32.5 points per game at home and 22.1 on the road.
I wonder why that is. That's interesting. A few weeks ago, they went to Cleveland, and it was a very windy day, and they just ran the ball all day. They didn't even try to throw. And so the reason I asked is wind is still a factor at times at MetLife, not like it was at the old Giants Stadium, but as we talked about on 10 Things a few weeks ago, you still see the trash bags fly across your screen on watching Giants home games. But they're in Pittsburgh. I didn't know that was that different of an offense at home versus on the road. That's astounding.
It is. Ben's been a different guy. So, yeah, that will be a fascinating one. Obviously, Giants have had a pretty easy slate as of late, but not only having to face the Steelers team, but having to face them in Pittsburgh is a whole other level of challenge for a rebuilt and reinvested defense. So this will be a real fun one to watch. 4 o'clock window on Sunday.
This is the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
If you're enjoying this podcast, then check out Open Floor with Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver.
My take is that once you start having opinions on whose jersey is being retired around the league, that's when you're officially like in too deep with League Pass.
Good news. Go ahead. I also have invented the jersey retirement formula, which you can Google and it will tell you. No, I really have done this.
Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, let's move on to the Sunday nighter. This is Panthers at Seahawks. Panthers, if they're not dead already, they're on life support here. But the thing we want to focus on in this game is the quarterback tight end combinations. And we'll start with the Carolina guys because, last October, I think people hadn't quite bought into the Panthers when they went out to Seattle and they ended up pulling off the upset in this game. And Greg Olsen played a huge role in it, had 7 for 131 and a touchdown. You just wouldn't expect a tight end, running middle of the field where you got Bobby Wagner and you have Earl Thomas and you have Cam Chancellor. Why does Olsen present such a challenge for this Seahawks defense?
We know what the Seahawks are going to play. They're going to play their matchup cover three concepts, and they have expanded those a little bit. They do more out of them than they used to, but at the core, for the most part, that's the way they've played. And what Carolina has done the last few times they've faced Seattle is find the right route combinations that attack that. And one of those areas that can be weak is down the seams, depending on what you do with some of your other routes. But you can every coverage, Gary, has flaws. That's inherent. And so you have to locate those flaws. And Carolina does a very good job of locating the flaws of cover three with vertical routes. And a lot of them involve the seams and a wide receiver on the outside going down vertically together. And Olsen's the guy who's going to run the seams.
Yeah. Well, look, this on the other side of the ball. Now, this was Marshawn Lynch was still playing football at this point when these teams met last year. Jimmy Graham, had the really disappointing 2015 season, but he had 8 for 140 in this game. This was really the highlight of his first season with the Seahawks. Now it's obviously a much different offense are running, a lot of spread stuff, a lot of timing stuff. They didn't play very well last week in Tampa. They're getting a Panthers defense that it looks like Luke Kuechly's still out with a concussion, didn't practice on Wednesday. I think there's a real chance he misses his second straight game here. But, is this Panthers defense capable of handling Jimmy Graham?
That's another tough matchup, of course. And what makes it hard is that Jimmy Graham moves all over the formation. And Carolina is a zone-based defense, which means their defenders do not move all over the formation.
Yeah.
So Seattle could get Graham matched on a cornerback if they want by putting him out wide. They could get him matched on a safety by putting him in the slot, or they could get him matched on a linebacker by putting him in his usual spot along the line of scrimmage tight end position. And I think they'll do all of the above. And they'll mix and match and find what works best. And the ball's probably going to come out quickly because they have an offensive line you can't rely on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they've played when they've played well. That's what they've done. Last week against Tampa Bay, the ball wasn't getting out for a variety of reasons. The routes weren't working. Russell Wilson wasn't comfortable, and the O-line didn't play well. And so it's going to come down to how on schedule can they play. And it's good we're talking about Jimmy Graham, because where he lines up will often dictate where the ball is going and what the play design is. And that's all about – that's what playing on schedule is all about.
Yeah, I don't want to say blueprint, but is there anything that you saw with what Tampa did last week that maybe the Panthers can employ this week, even without Kuechly?
Tampa, from what I could tell, I'll be honest, I watched the television copy, so I didn't see, you can't watch every single snap on film, and I haven't gotten to that film yet. So you can't see the coverages, but the way they were rushing four, which means they were playing their seven-man coverages behind, and almost all of their seven-man coverages involve some form of zone, whether it's three high zone or four high zone or Tampa two, cover two. And that's very basic stuff, but it's quicker timing dropback. So the zone defenders who would be at the forefront of those and making the stops would be your shorter zone defenders, not your safeties, but your linebackers, your cornerbacks, if they're getting in any kind of press position. And I would, to answer your question, Gary, I think you need to challenge the Seahawks. I think you need to – you're not going to be a press defense if you're Carolina, because you just don't play that way. But you're going to need James Bradbury to be physical. He's going to have to at least line up in press position. And same with Worley. And Thomas Davis is tremendous in that regard, so you don't need to worry about that one. But they need to be the aggressors, and their mindset needs to be, we're going to beat these guys in the first 1.5 seconds of the play. And that's really more of a man coverage type of mindset. But I think they'll do it out of zone, because man coverage is tough to play against Seattle, because you get the Russell Wilson scrambling factor, and also so Seattle does such a good job getting Baldwin open on man beaters off the line of scrimmage. So I'd be very aggressive with my zones, and then you're counting on your defensive line to clean up the mess from there.
All right. Well, this will be a good one Sunday night. And look, I had given Andy the option of picking the third game here. I thought those first two games are the one we would talk, the ones we would talk about. And I said, Andy, pick whatever third game you want to discuss. But I was secretly hoping we would talk Dolphins-Ravens. So I let out a squeal of joy when you emailed with some notes on Miami-Baltimore here.
Well, you declared this the Saturday wildcard playoff game for this year, so I thought we might as well go ahead and just get on top of it now.
We can just rerun this in January now.
Yes, absolutely, and we'll need that kind of free time for other playoff games anyway. So this is going to be a very good matchup, too, because what Miami's done, and they haven't run the ball particularly well the last 2 weeks, but Tannehill's played so tremendously that it's worked out for him still. He's playing at an extremely high level, but they are a running team. They're going to have to be that. That's going to be their MO if they're to continue on the streak they've set themselves on. And I don't know if you can do that against Baltimore. Baltimore's run defense right now, it's the best in the NFL. And I thought, I know Dallas a few weeks ago wound up putting up pretty good run numbers against them, but just watching that film and seeing the way that game flowed, especially early in the game, I thought Baltimore was the better unit up front. I thought their defensive line beat Dallas's offensive line, and Miami's offensive line's in shambles, even if everyone does get healthy and those backups have been playing well on the left side. But even if everyone's healthy, there really aren't teams in the NFL right now capable of running against Brandon Williams and Michael Pierce and Lawrence Guy and Terrell Suggs, for that matter. That's an incredibly hard defensive line to run against.
Well, yeah, the Dolphins have been banged up front over the past 2 weeks, and that certainly played a role in their less effective run game here. According to Adam Beasley, the Miami Herald, Brandon Albert will probably be back this week. It sounds like Laremy Tunsil will also be ready to make a return.
Good.
We all love Laremy Tunsil at left guard there. Mike Pouncey might not be back, but hey, you got four-fifths of that very good group back together. And look, I know I thought this when they went up against the Jets a couple weeks ago. They'll run over bad teams, but this running game won't run over the Jets. And they did. They went and ran over the Jets. So this is I'm glad these guys are back, and I think this is a really, really nice matchup on that side of the ball. The Miami offense, their running game against the Ravens defense. And We'll swing over to the other side of the ball.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry, Gary. One thing that to add in, because that Jets game, it's a great point, and the Jets are similar to Baltimore talent-wise, mm-hmm. and Miami stuck with the run even when it wasn't working, which is that's new for Adam Gase. San Francisco last week beat Miami's run game a number of times with just the way they lined up, some of the wrinkles to their fronts. A lot of outside zone running teams, that's all about angles and timing with outside zone. And so if you line your defensive linemen and linebackers up just a little bit differently, you can compromise the angles and the timing. And I just want to throw that out there, that there's new film out there now with San Francisco. Yeah. They did a very good job of giving problems to those guys. So I don't know if Miami has a lot of checks at the run game, if Tannehill has how much freedom he has to change run plays. I would imagine he has some, but that could be a factor there, because they're going to see some run fronts that they don't like from the Ravens.
All right, very good. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Andy, but now we will swing over to the other side of the ball. We've talked about the Ravens run game and how they have been so weirdly quick to abandon the run, even though that was supposed to be Marty Morningweg's whole thing when he took over as offensive coordinator. They did a little bit better last week when they beat the Bengals. The Dolphins do not defend the run particularly well from a statistical standpoint. Is this a week where the Ravens can really get it going? They last week was also, I believe, the first time this season where Kenneth Dixon received more playing time than Terrence West up front. I think Dixon can do. He does a little bit more in the passing game, and I think he's a potential star in the run game as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. He's been very good in pass protection this season, and he's a guy I think you'd be comfortable throwing the ball to in certain dump-off scenarios as well. So then that's why he's going to play more. Guys who passing downs, there's just more passing downs than yep. running downs in the NFL, even if you're a running team, because when you go yeah. 2 minutes, that's where all the passing plays come, and you run about 10 of those. You run those much faster than run plays. So, Dixon, but what I like about Dixon is he and West are very similar stylistically. In fact, I find myself constantly reminding myself which guy is which number. West is 28,
yeah.
Dixon is 30, because if you just watch them without the jersey number, you might not tell who's who. They're very similar, and they have good, and West is the better runner to me. Dixon's maybe the more diverse player, but they have good vision. They're agile, they're fast and quick. Those are two good NFL running back. So I would hope that they would run in this game. In Miami, as good as they might be the second best team talent-wise in the NFL at D tackle, behind only the Ravens, and yet their run defense ranks way down there. They really don't have very good linebacker play in Miami this season.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny you say that about Dixon West. I always do the same thing. You can't really see who ran the ball until the play ends and you can see the uniform number.
Yeah.
West goes 5'10", 225. Dixon goes 5'10", 215. So
earlier this year, I tweeted a film note, and I referred to – it was one guy on the play, and I referred to both of them in the same sentence. I said, West had an excellent pass block, blah, 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 and Dixon stepped up and hit the guy late. It was one of my
nice.
Lower tweets. Yeah. Well, and the thing was, it still made sense. That's how similar these guys are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. Those are the three games that we are watching this weekend. Well, we're watching all the games, but those are the three we are really excited about. And we're going to move on to the mailbag. We're going to do a mailbag every week on this show, and we're going to try and do it with the heart and soul of the lightning-ish round. We're going to get to as many of these as possible. Andy, I'm going to throw them out, and I will let you provide the answer. Now, this first one, I will say the most common question we get is Derek Carr and Andy's thoughts on Derek Carr. Most of them are horribly mean. Just the language. Shame on all of you.
But they're Andy, loyal fans. They're loyal fans there in Oakland. It's
they're actually
it's
they've actually
fine.
Been they haven't been that mean. But Andy, you had the quote about Carr hyperbolizing that he maybe wasn't a top 20 quarterback. At One Sec Bunny asks, since he was down a finger last week, does this mean he breaks your top 20 QBs? I would simply ask, what is your what's your assessment of Derek Carr these days?
Well, since I said that, I think he's played three games, is it? And it was right after the Tampa Bay game. I know his last two games, the Texans game was kind of a snapshot of the issues I think I've seen with Carr. In fact, I know I've seen with Carr this season. And there's an unevenness to his play. Some of the decision-making wasn't there. He didn't play on time in some spots. He wasn't as precise and accurate as you'd want. That was in the Texans game, though. Keep in mind, they're winning through all of this anyway. So it's not like Carr's a bum. I've never said that. I think he's a star talent, and he needs to be held to that expectation and pushed to play to that level. He absolutely played to that level last week against Carolina. In that fact, next to the Bucs game, that was his best outing of the season. I thought he played on time on every snap. He had one bad play, result in the interception where he didn't see Thomas Davis. It was a very poor choice to throw in the middle of the field late in the down. You don't do that ever against a zone defense, really any defense. But that was it, though. It was the one bad play. He happened to pay a price for it. Everything else, he was very, very good on film.
Okay. I'm going to stop you before you put a ranking on him and everyone gets really upset again.
I appreciate that, yeah, because I don't. People, it's the ranking thing that does it. That's what gets people like numbers attached to guys. It gives them comfort and answers and something to hold on to. I don't know where Derek Carr ranks. Just I don't know where any of the QBs rank. We're just watching football.
He ranks as having 9 good fingers right now. This next one is coming from at Vienna Falcons. Desmond Trufant, this is a shame. He's out for the year with the pectoral injury. Jalen Collins steps in. What do you know about Jalen Collins, Andy?
I know that Carson Palmer likes playing against him because I've never seen a quarterback go after one cornerback so ruthlessly and continuously as Palmer did down the stretch against Atlanta in their last game. And Collins, I think he grades out as I give him a C-plus during that time when he was getting picked on, which is fine. If a C is average, he gives a little bit above average. He did fine. But he's the guy, Gary. That's the most important player on that defense now because Trufant was the best. They've lost him. And if you have a weak spot at cornerback, especially in a zone defense where you often know where that corner is going to align up, then offenses, that's where they go after you. And Atlanta has a pass rush that's hit or miss each week. Some weeks it looks amazing. Other weeks you don't even see it at all. So if the pass rush gets quiet and teams are going to have an opportunity to go after Collins and he's got to be the guy now, I like him overall. I'm optimistic. I'll put it that way. He's long-armed. I think he's willing to be physical. He moves well enough. I'm very eager to see more, though.
I always hated that LSU had a Jalen Mills and a Jalen Collins in the same secondary. That's all I'll say about him. That was driving me nuts.
And now they're both playing critical roles for teams that are pretty much in the playoff hunt. Philadelphia
in the playoff hunt, absolutely. Philadelphia still is. Yeah. This next one's coming from Jonathan Lee, and that name is trademarked. At Dijon Ketchups, what happened in Cincinnati defensively? That's a good question. What's going on with his defenses here, Andy?
It's been up and down. It's really not a great pass rush. We think it is because Dunlap on his best days at left defensive end looks as good as any player in the league. But there's another highly inconsistent guy, and they don't know why he's that way. Nobody knows why he's that way. But he's really their only good pass rusher other than Geno Atkins. And defensive tackles, it can be hard for them to dictate pass rushing terms as much because they don't play in space and they don't have the room. So Dunlap, if he doesn't produce, then the pass rush doesn't get home. And if the pass rush doesn't get home, it's very difficult to play cover two or two high zone coverage variations of it, which is what they do there in Cincinnati. So they're a very vanilla defense schematically. That's fine. You've got to have better players than everybody else to do that. And that starts up front. And up front, their guys just haven't been the better players often enough this season.
Yeah. And connected, this is coming from Liam Doyle at @who_he_play_for. Do you think the Bengals OL can improve for next year? And what should they do? Draft, sign new personnel? I mean, part of the problem here is, you know, 2 years ago they took Cedric Ogbuehi. How do you say that, Andy?
Ogbuehi.
Ogbuehi?
Oh, Grace, it might not matter for long. If he plays the way he's been playing, he's not going to be in the league.
He was their first-round pick, and Jake Fisher was their second-round pick.
Right.
You know, one's been a disaster, and one hasn't been able to get on the field. And, I mean, that's a lot of capital to put into those two guys who are giving you very little at the moment.
And I was surprised that Ogbrehe became the right tackle this season ahead of Fisher. I would have thought, because they love his athleticism and Ogbrehe's athleticism. So I would have thought he's your left tackle and Fisher's your right tackle, and might as well start developing Fisher at the right tackle spot right now. They're not ready to replace Whitworth at left tackle, even though he's 1,000 years old. He's playing at a very high level still. Yeah. So it was an embarrassment of riches, or so it seemed. But here's what happened. You're right. Fisher hasn't gotten on the field yet. He's looked good when he's in there as a sixth lineman, but he hasn't been a down-to-down player. But the big problem, Gary, is that Ogbrehe cannot handle the bull rush. It's a significant issue.
Yeah.
It's a big enough issue that if it doesn't correct itself, he will not be in the NFL for long. So that's their issue. And then the interior offensive line, they've been they haven't been as good there mentally or physically as they were a year ago. And that's surprising because those are some veteran guys, Zeitler, Bowling, Bodine. They've been under the same coach for many years, Paul Alexander, who a lot of people respect and think very highly of. And for whatever reason, it's the fine line in the NFL. We talked about it with Arizona. All it takes is guys to play a tick worse than they have, and suddenly you're a weak spot and a big downgrade.
Yep. No, and look, it's been such a strength for such a long time. When they took those two guys in 2015, I bet they had they were thinking that Andrew Whitworth would not be with the team in 2017. He's a free agent next offseason. I don't see how they can do anything but sign him at this point, even though he is, as you said, 1,000 years old. No, he's right. 35? He'll be...
Keep in mind with Whitworth, in 2013, at the end of that season, he played guard for them. He had to due to injuries.
Yeah. Yep.
And he was a monster at guard, and to the point that I was shocked that they, even though I know left tackle is considered a more valuable position, I was shocked they didn't convert him to a long-term guard right there and try to extend his career. And when they drafted these guys, these offensive tackles, I thought for sure they're moving Whitworth to guard. Maybe that's an option now. If guards become a position of concern, maybe you move Whitworth inside and put Fisher at left tackle, or try Ogbrehe there and hope he gets better in the offseason. I don't know, but they have enough bodies to figure it out, but some of their guys just have to play better. It makes it easier when they play better, doesn't it?
Yeah, and look, they have to pray that Whitworth doesn't decide to hang him up after this year, do a little Jordan Gross type thing. This next one is coming from Sean Bennett at Sean Bennett 23. What's the reason for the lack of production and down year for Mo Wilkerson? Lack of effort, more double teams? What do you think, Andy?
I'm not going to call it a lack of effort. Very few guys have effort issues in the NFL. I'm not saying it's not that either, though. We've heard some reports that Wilkerson hasn't been all there in practice or meetings at times. Whether those reports are true or not, we've heard them, and he's been paid, so it's just something to keep in mind. I don't know the answer to the question, to be honest, though. He flashes the talent every once in a while. He hasn't flashed the talent nearly as often. The guy who's played the best on that defensive line is the guy that I was surprised they ever brought in the first place. That's Leonard Williams. I didn't think they needed him, given who else they had there, but he's been their best defensive lineman this season.
Yeah. We got two more here. One's coming from Rodrigo at R. Quintanar. What offensive schemes would you use to avoid the handcuff strategy? I just thought this was a fun one. I don't know what you do. I guess if you have someone in the backfield, you say, if you see that going on, run straight upfield. We're going to throw a Hail Mary to the end zone and hope something good happens.
No, the only scheme you can – I appreciate that question because he was listening to our 10 Things show that on Monday morning, so that's nice of him. The only thing you can do, the scheme is you go to your owner, you say, hey, call Goodell, tell him to tell the competition committee to fix this because there's no answer for it, and it's a flaw in the rule book. There's nothing you – if everybody grabs you and holds you, you can't do anything. And I watched that I went back and watched that Bengals play against the Ravens. It was interesting to me. Did you see how long it took the refs to throw the flag on the holding? It was like 4 seconds into the down before the refs noticed what was going on.
Yep. It was completely bizarre.
Yeah.
No one
Everybody
knew what
was shocked by that. Everybody was shocked by that. I would love to. I wish NFL Films had each of those guys mic'd up on Cincinnati so we could just see a montage of each player's reaction to that, because it was some, I'm sure, very vitriolic variation of, hey, what the hell was that?
Yeah, and look, that play went for 11 seconds or only 11 seconds on the clock. That could have gone on for 20, 25 seconds.
I know.
I mean, Cook hung out in the end zone when the clock was on zero for a little while.
All right. All right, one more thing, and then we're going to – I know we got to wrap the show up, but since you mentioned him, why is Sam Cook allowed to call himself Cook? His name is K-O-C-H, and we have an English language, and we have plenty of pronunciations that account for K-O-C-H. Sam Cook's name is Koch, and I don't know how he gets away with this, just saying, hey, I'm Cook now.
I don't know. I bet he used to be Koch, and then Luke Kuechly got really good, and he decided he was going to go with an alternative pronunciation of his own name.
Yeah.
It was just a cool thing to do.
There was a lady that worked at my college when I was young, and her name was K-U-C-K, and she went by Cook. I can kind of understand why you'd want to not be called K-U-C-K. It's not a bad word. It just sounds like a lot of bad words. But Sam Cook needs to be Sam Koch. It's nothing wrong with Koch. That's a neat little name.
Yeah. No, nothing wrong with it. By the way, do you know who the who's going to go in the first round, tight end from Michigan?
No.
Jake Butt. B-U-T-T. He seems to really embrace it, too. His Twitter handle something like JakeBooty88 or something like that. So,
well, there was Mario Butts when I was a kid, but that like plural. Like, but
Marion
Butts.
You could
never
accuse
a man
Butts.
Of being two butts, like two asses. And so Jake Butt, to embrace that, because that's singular, that's pretty good.
Well, I'll just say, and this is the last thing I'll say about Butts. I'm in a college fantasy football league. Jake Butt is my tight end. And my dream, and it was dashed in the last round of the draft, Virginia's tight end is Evan Butts. And I wanted Jake Butt and Evan Butts on the same team.
Yeah.
Didn't work out.
No, you can't have everything.
I know. All right, last question here. This was supposed to be the silly one, the last one. This is from at I Am Rainbow Cave. I see a lot of free plays whistled dead this year. The jumping off sides, Rodgers and Big Ben don't like it. What is the exact rule there? Sometimes they get free plays, sometimes not. I mean, the rule is simply if you make contact, defensive player makes contact with the offensive player, it's dead before the snap. If an offensive player jumps, it's dead. That happened Monday night. Rodgers was complaining, but whoever his right guard was on Monday night jumped. Rodgers thought it was a free play. It shouldn't have been. It was correctly whistled dead. Mm-hmm. Or if the defensive player is unabated to the quarterback and is just going to maul him, kind of like Richard Sherman on Dan Carpenter, that's a player safety thing. Now, I think it's really dumb that the play is not whistled dead immediately, regardless when someone jumps off sides. I think this free play stuff is one. The offense doesn't need any more advantages. I think there's enough rules in football right now that give the passing game an advantage. And number two, and this happens every once in a while, a guy will jump off sides and will be almost unabated, but not quite. And then an offensive lineman, in order to save his quarterback from being mauled, will hold the player who jumped off sides. And then it's offsetting penalties. And it's like, well, you only held because the guy jumped off sides.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you, and I haven't thought about getting rid of it. I guess I wouldn't mind that. I know I had my Alan Oy, my film charter guy, went through and looked at all of Rodgers' passes last year, and I think he had 4 touchdowns, if I remember, on those offsides. His passing numbers on those jump-off sides plays, he didn't have a ton of them, but the numbers were astronomical. I'm kind of with you on that, and your point about the holding is a good one. What people always forget, announcers will always say, oh, he's flagged for holding, that cost him a first down, or that cost him a touchdown taken off the board. 99% of the time, those first downs, those touchdowns on the holding penalties, they would not have occurred without the holding penalties.
Yeah, so exactly.
You almost never watch film and say, well, they had a touchdown, except that guy had a penalty, and that ruined it. The penalty creates the touchdown, so the touchdown was never a touchdown to begin with. I like your point.
14 players on the field, they wouldn't have scored a touchdown.
Right.
It. Yeah. All right, Andy, we have one more thing before we go. Your bold prediction for Sunday or Monday.
Nobody told me we were doing these bold prediction things. This is absolutely the first I've heard of it. We're going to really do this?
Yes. Andy, I emailed you, I called you, I sent you a letter as well.
Yeah, you did none of those. Jeff Irwin suggested it, our researcher, and I guess someone decided to do it. Why don't I, you know, I don't like this stuff. Why don't you do yours first, and then I'll try to, like, I'll think of something by then.
All right, I think the Seahawks are going to hammer the Panthers. I mean, it's not bold to say the Seahawks will win this game at home, but I think this one is going to get out of hand. I think this is this is going to be a 3-touchdown game.
All right, I think the Panthers will make it relatively competitive. for three quarters, and then the best team will win in the fourth.
That's the least bold thing ever said.
I don't know these bold. There's nothing to lose on the bold predictions. You
give
get
me
it wrong,
one.
Go, wow,
no,
it was
well,
a bold
give
prediction.
Me one surprising thing. Give me one like, oh, I like this guy's matchup, and it can be based in knowledge and reality and research.
All right. Jeez. What? Okay. I think Ladarius Webb will be the most important player on the field for the Ravens-Dolphins game. He's the guy that's going to have to take Landry in the slot. A lot of times Webb moved back to the slot with Matt Elam now healthy or I guess back from suspension. Webb has looked very good at safety this season. He was phenomenal at strong safety when he and Weddle were switching spots last week, and he was even better in his old slot position. So I think he'll have a monster game. No one will know because a monster game means nothing was thrown at him. But I think he'll have a monster game against Jarvis Landry in the slot, and that's going to be the difference in the game.
Well, there you go. That was good. That was bold. And I'll add for Andy, Andy also thinks Justin Tucker is going to miss a 19-yard field goal that would have potentially won it.
I put Justin Tucker in my film notes this week because the field goals he made within the context of how that game was being called and flowed, those were hugely significant. To get 350-plus yarders in the way they got them, Baltimore doesn't win that game without them. So Justin Tucker's – in fact, he'll be my special teams player of the week for the remainder of the season on this 10 things show that we do. We do the special teams at the end of the show, and that's going to be good because that'll take care of the special teams guy for the year for me.
If his kicks too, if you put a third upright in like the geometric center of the the crossbar there, he'd hit it on some of these 50-yard kicks.
Yep, he's a great player.
He is exceptional. All right, Andy, that is the show. As always, you will be able to catch Andy and I in our regular 10 Things podcast coming out Monday mornings. We will look back upon what went on in Week 13. As for this show, that'll do it. Thanks to our researcher, Jeff Irwin, and as always to the folks at Digital Media, Matt Hevia, Chris Basil, always make us sound so good. And thank you so much for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things Look Ahead podcast. You guys really are the best. Andy and I always enjoy hearing from you. Please contact us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGramling_SI. We are also on Facebook. Email us, talkback@themmqb.com. It's all very good. Remember to listen and to subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You will get the Monday one. You will get the Thursday one. It will make your life complete. Get them wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Monday morning.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.